careful instructions, and this is what they led to. I started to rise, but Chade's hand suddenly gripped my shoulder. Or a man can live 2 years, or five, or a decade longer than any thought he could, and bring the wisdom and tolerance of age to the negotiations. Or a babe can be cured of a strangling cough, and the mother suddenly see with gratitude that what we offer can be beneficial to all involved. The hand doesn't always deal death, my boy. Not always. Often enough, I never lied to you about that. I heard two things in Chade's voice that I had never heard before, defensiveness and hurt. But youth is merciless. I don't think I want to learn any more from you. I think I'm going to go to Shrewd and tell him to find someone else to kill people for him. That is your decision to make. But I advise you against it. For now. His calmness caught me off guard. Why? Because it would negate all chivalry tried to do for you. It would draw attention to you. And right now, that is not a good idea. His words came ponderously slow, freighted with truth. Why? I found I was whispering. Because some will be wanting to write fini to chivalry's story completely. And that would be best done by eliminating you. Those ones will be watching how you react to your father's death. Does it give you ideas and make you restless? Will you become a problem now? The way he was. What? My boy, he said, and pulled me close against his side. For the first time I heard the possession in his words. It is time for you to be quiet and careful. I understand why Burrich cut your hair, but in truth I wish he had not. I wish no one had been reminded that chivalry was your father. You are such a hatchling yet. But listen to me. For now, change nothing that you do. Wait 6 months, a year. Then decide. But for now... How did my father die? Chade's eyes searched my face. Did you not hear that he fell from a horse? Yes, and I heard Burrich curse the man who told it, saying that chivalry would not fall, nor would that horse throw him. Burrich needs to guard his tongue. Then how did my father die? I don't know. But like Burrich, I do not believe he fell from a horse. Chade fell silent. I sank down to sit by his bony bare feet and stare into his fire. Are they going to kill me too? He was silent a long while. I don't know. Not if I can help it. I think they must first convince King Shrewd it is necessary. And if they do that, I shall know of it.
Then you think it comes from within the keep?
I do.
Chade waited long, but I was silent, refusing to ask. He answered anyway.
I knew nothing of it before it happened. I had no hand in it in any way. They didn't even approach me about it. Probably because they know I would have done more than just refuse, I would have seen to it that it never happened.
Oh. I relaxed a little. But already he had trained me too well in the ways of court thinking. Then they probably won't come to you if they decide they want me done. They'd be afraid of your warning me as well. He took my chin in his hand and turned my face so that I looked into his eyes.
Your father's death should be all the warning you need, now or ever. You're a bastard, boy. We're always a risk and a vulnerability. We're always expendable, except when we are an absolute necessity to their own security. I've taught you quite a bit these last few years, but hold this lesson closest and keep it always before you. If ever you make it so they don't need you, they will kill you. I looked at him wide-eyed. They don't need me now. Don't they? I grow old. You are young and tractable, with the face and bearing of the royal family. As long as you don't show any inappropriate ambitions, you'll be fine. He paused, then carefully emphasized, "We are the king's, boy. His exclusively, in a way perhaps you have not thought about. No one knows what I do, and most have forgotten who I am, or was. If any know of us, it is from the king." I sat, putting it cautiously together. "Then, you said it came from within the keep, but if you were not used, then it was not from the king." "The queen!" I said it with sudden certainty.
Chade's eyes guarded his thoughts.
"That's a dangerous assumption to make. Even more dangerous if you think you must act on it in some way."
"Why?"
Chade sighed. "When you spring to an idea and decide it is the truth, without evidence, you blind yourself to other possibilities. Consider them all, boy. Perhaps it was an accident. Perhaps Chivalry was killed by someone he had offended at Witherwoods. Perhaps it had nothing to do with him being a prince, or perhaps the king has another assassin. One I know nothing about. And it was the king's own hand against his son."
"You don't believe any of those?" I said with certainty.
"No, I don't. Because I have no evidence to declare them truth, just as I have no evidence to say your father's death was the queen's hand striking. That is all I remember of our conversation then. But I am sure that Chade had deliberately led me to consider who might have acted against my father, to instill in me a greater wariness of the queen. I held the thought close to me, and not just in the days that immediately followed. I kept myself to my chores, and slowly my hair grew, and by the beginning of real summer, all seemed to have returned to normal. Once every few weeks I would find myself sent off to town on errands. I soon came to see that no matter who sent me, one or two items on the list wound up in Chade's quarters, so I guessed who was behind my little bouts of freedom. I did not manage to spend time with Molly every time I went to town, but it was enough for me that I would stand outside the window of her shop until she noticed me, and at least exchange a nod. Once I heard someone in the market talking about the quality of her scented candles, and how no one had made such a pleasant and healthful taper since her mother's day. And I smiled for her, and was glad. Summer came, bringing warmer weather to our coasts, and with it, the out-islanders. Some came as honest traders, with cold lands goods to trade, furs and amber, and ivory, and kegs of oil, and tall tales to share, ones that still could prickle my neck, just as they had when I was small. Our sailors did not trust them, and called them spies, and worse. But their goods were rich, and the gold they brought to purchase our wines and grains was solid and heavy, and our merchants took it. And other out-islanders also visited our shores, though not too close to Buckkeep Hold. They came with knives and torches, with bows and rams, to plunder and rape the same villages they had been plundering and raping for years. Sometimes it seemed an elaborate and bloody contest, they to find villages unaware or underarmed, and for us to lure them in with seemingly vulnerable targets and then slaughter and plunder the pirates themselves. But if it were a contest, it went very badly for us that summer. My every visit to town was heavy with the news of destruction and the mutterings of the people. Up at the keep, among the men-at-arms, there was a collective feeling of doltishness that I shared. The out-islanders eluded our patrol ships with ease and never fell into our traps,
They struck where we were undermanned, and least expecting it. Most discomfited of all was Verity, for to him had fallen the task of defending the kingdom once chivalry had abdicated. I heard it muttered in the taverns that since he had lost his elder brother's good counsel, all had gone sour. No one spoke against Verity yet, but it was unsettling that no one spoke out strongly for him either. Boyishly, I viewed the raids as a thing impersonal to me. Certainly they were bad things, and I felt sorry in a vague way for those villagers whose homes were torched or plundered. But, secure at Buckkeep, I had very little feeling for the constant fear and vigilance that other seaports endured, or for the agonies of villagers who rebuilt each year, only to see their efforts torched the next. I was not to keep my ignorant innocence long. I went down to Burridge for my lesson one morning, though I spent as much time doctoring animals and teaching young colts and fillies as I did in being taught. I had very much taken over Cobb's place in the stables, while he had gone on to being Regal's groom and dogman, but that day, to my surprise, Burridge took me upstairs to his room, and sat me down at his table. I dreaded spending a tedious morning repairing tack.
"I'm going to teach you manners today," Burridge announced suddenly.
There was doubt in his voice, as if he were skeptical of my ability to learn such.
"With horses?" I asked incredulously.
"No, you've those already. With people. At table and afterward, when folks sit and talk with one another. Those sorts of manners."
"Why?"
Burridge frowned. "Because, for reasons I don't understand, you're to accompany Verity when he goes to Neatbay to see Duke Kelvar of Ripon. Lord Kelvar has not been cooperating with Lord Shemshai in manning the coastal towers. Shemshai accuses him of leaving towers completely without watches, so that the out-islanders are able to sail past and even anchor outside of Watch Island, and from there raid Shemshai's villages in Shoke's duchy. Prince Verity is going to consult with Kelvar about these allegations."
I grasped the situation completely. It was common gossip around Buckkeep Town. Lord Kelvar of Ripon duchy had 3 watchtowers in his keeping. The 2 that bracketed the points of Neatbay were always well manned, for they protected the best harbour in Ripon duchy. But the tower on Watch Island protected little of Ripon that was worth much to Lord Kelvar. His high and rocky coastline sheltered few villages, and would-be raiders would have a hard time keeping their ships off the rocks while raiding. His southern coast was seldom bothered. Watch Island itself was home to little more than gulls, goats, and a hefty population of clams. Yet the tower there was critical to the early defense of South Cove in Shoke's duchy. It commanded views of both the inner and outer channels, and was placed on a natural summit that allowed its beacon fires to be easily seen from the mainland. Shemshai himself had a watchtower on Egg Island, but Egg was little more than a bit of sand that stuck up above the waves on high tide. It commanded no real view of the water, and was constantly in need of repair from the shifting of the sands and the occasional storm tide that overwhelmed it. But it could see a watchfire warning light from Watch Island, and send the message on, as long as Watch Island Tower lit such a fire. Traditionally, the fishing grounds and clamming beaches of Watch Island were the territory of Ripon Duchy, and so the manning of the watchtower there had fallen to Ripon Duchy as well. But maintaining a garrison there meant bringing in men and their victuals, and also supplying wood and oil for the beacon fires, and maintaining the tower itself from the savage ocean storms that swept across the barren little island. It was an unpopular duty station for men-at-arms, and rumor had it that to be stationed there was a subtle form of punishment for unruly or unpolitical garrisons. More than once, when in his cups, Kelvar had declaimed that if manning the tower was so important to Shoke's duchy, then Lord Shemshai should do it himself. Not that Ripon duchy was interested in surrendering the fishing grounds off the island, or the rich shellfish beds. So, when Shokes's villages were raided, without warning, in an early spring spree that destroyed all hopes of the fields being planted on time, as well as saw most of the pregnant sheep either slaughtered, stolen, or scattered, Lord Shemshai had protested loudly to the king that Kelvar had been lax in manning his towers. Kelvar denied it, and asserted that the small force he had installed there was suitable for a location that seldom needed to be defended. "Watchers, not soldiers, are what Watch Island Tower requires," he had declared, and for that purpose he had recruited a number of elderly men and women to man the tower. A handful of them had been soldiers, but most were refugees from Neat Bay, debtors and pickpockets, and aging whores, some declared, while supporters of Kelvar asserted they were but elderly citizens in need of secure employment. All this I knew better from tavern gossip and Chade's political lectures than Burridge could imagine, but I bit my tongue and sat through his detailed and strained explanation. Not for the first time I realized he considered me slightly slow. My silences he mistook for a lack of wit, rather than a lack of any need to speak. So now, laboriously, Burridge began to instruct me in the manners that, he told me, most other boys picked up simply by being around their elders. I was to greet people when I first encountered them each day, or if I walked into a room and found it occupied, melting silently away was not polite. I should call folk by their names, and if they were older than me or of higher political station, as, he reminded me, almost anyone I met on this journey would be, I should address them by title as well. Then he inundated me with protocol. Who could precede me out of a room and under what circumstances? Almost anyone, and under almost all conditions, had precedent over me. And on to the manners of the table. To pay attention to where I was seated, to pay attention to whoever occupied the high seat at that table, and pace my dining accordingly. How to drink a toast, or a series of toasts, without overindulging myself, and how to speak engagingly, or, more likely, to listen attentively to whoever might be seated near me at dinner. And on, until I began to daydream wistfully of endlessly cleaning tack. Burridge recalled my attention with a sharp poke. "And you're not to do that either. You look an imbecile sitting there, nodding with your mind elsewhere. Don't fancy no one notices when you do that. And don't glare like that when you're corrected. Sit up straight and put a pleasant expression on your face. Not a vacuous smile, you dolt! Oh, Fitz, what am I to do with you? How can I protect you when you invite troubles on yourself? And why do they want to take you off like this anyway?" The last two questions, put to himself, betrayed his real concern. Perhaps I was a trifle stupid not to have seen it. He wasn't going. I was, for no good reason that he could discern. Burridge had lived long enough near court to be very cautious. For the first time since he had been entrusted with my care, I was being removed from his watchfulness. It had not been so long since my father had been buried, and so he wondered, though he didn't dare say, whether I would be coming back, or if someone was making the opportunity to quietly dispose of me. I realized what a blow to his pride and reputation it would be if I were to be vanished. So I sighed, and then carefully commented that perhaps they wanted an extra hand with the horses and dogs. Verity went nowhere without Leon, his wolfhound. Only 2 days before he had complimented me on how well I managed him. This I repeated to Burridge, and it was gratifying to see how well this small subterfuge worked. Relief flooded his face, then pride that he had taught me well. The topic instantly shifted from manners to the correct care of the wolfhound. If the lectures on manners had wearied me, the repetition of hound lore was almost painfully tedious. When he released me to go to my other lessons, I left with winged feet. I went through the rest of the day in a distracted haze that had Hod threatening me with a good whipping if I didn't attend to what I was doing. Then she shook her head over me, sighed, and told me to run along and come back when I had a mind again. I was only too happy to obey her. The thought of actually leaving Buckkeep and journeying all the way to Neat Bay, was all I could fit inside my head. I knew I should wonder why I was going, but felt sure Chade would advise me soon. Would we go by land or by sea? I wished I had asked Burridge. The roads to Neat Bay were not the best I'd heard, but I wouldn't mind. Sooty and I had never been on a long journey together. But a sea trip. On a real ship. I took the long way back to the keep, up a path that went through a lightly wooded bit of rocky hillside. Paper birches struggled there, and a few alder. But mostly, it was nondescript brush. Sunlight and a light breeze were playing together in the higher branches, giving the day a fey and dappled air. I lifted my eyes to the dazzle of sun through the birch leaves, and when I looked down, the king's fool stood before me. I stopped in my tracks, astonished. Reflexively, I looked for the king, despite how ridiculous it would have been to find him here. But the fool was alone. And outside, in the daylight. The thought made the hair on my arms and neck stand up in my tightened skin. It was common knowledge in the keep that the king's fool could not abide the light of day. Common knowledge. Yet, despite what every page and kitchen maid muttered knowingly, there stood the fool, pale hair floating in the light breeze. The blue and red silk of his motley jacket and trousers was startlingly bright against his paleness, but his eyes were not as colourless as they were in the dim passages of the keep. As I received their stare from only a few feet away in the light of day, I perceived there was a blueness to them, very pale, as if a single drop of pale blue wax had fallen onto a white platter. The whiteness of his skin was an illusion also, for out here in the dappling sunlight I could see a pinkness suffused him from within. Blood, I realized with a sudden quailing. Red blood, showing through layers of skin. The fool took no notice of my whispered comment. Instead, a finger was held aloft, as if to pause not only my thoughts, but the very day around us. That I could not have focused my attention more completely on anything, and when he was satisfied of this, the fool smiled, showing small, white, separate teeth, like a baby's new smile, in a boy's mouth.
"Fitz!"
he intoned in a piping voice.
"Fitz, Fitz, 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 Fats, Fitz."
He stopped abruptly, and again gave me that smile. I stared back uncertainly, without word or movement. Again the finger soared aloft, and this time was shaken at me.
"Fitz! Fitz, Fix, Vice, Fitz! Fats, Svitzes."
He cocked his head at me, and the movement sent the dandelion fluff of his hair wafting in a new direction. I was beginning to lose my fear of him. "Fitz," I said carefully, and tapped my chest with my forefinger. "Fitz, that's me. Yes, my name is Fitz. Are you lost?" I tried to make my voice gentle and reassuring, so as not to alarm the poor creature, for surely he had somehow wandered off from the keep, and that was why he seemed so delighted to find a familiar face. He took a breath through his nose, and then shook his head violently, until his hair stood out all around his skull like a flame around a wind-blown candle.
"Fitz!"
he said emphatically, his voice cracking a little.
"Fitz, Fitzes, Fices, Fitz, Fatsifices."
"It's all right," I said soothingly. I crouched a bit, though in reality I was not that much taller than the fool. I made a soft beckoning motion with my open hand. "Come along, then. Come along, I'll show you the way back home, all right? Don't be afraid now. Abruptly, the fool dropped his hands to his sides. Then he lifted his face and rolled his eyes at the heavens. He looked back at me, fixedly, and poked his mouth out as if he wanted to spit. Come along now. I beckoned to him again.
No!
He said, quite plainly, in an exasperated voice.
Listen to me, you idiot! Fits, fixes, fices, fits. Fatsuffices.
What? I asked, startled.
I said...
He enunciated elaborately.
Fits, fixes, fice, fits. Fat suffices.
He bowed, turned, and began to walk away from me, up the trail. Wait! I demanded. My ears were turning red with my embarrassment. How do you politely explain to someone that you had believed for years that he was a moron as well as a fool? I couldn't. So, what does all that fitsy-ficies stuff mean? Are you making fun of me?
Hardly.
He paused long enough to turn and say,
Fits, fixes, feists, fits. Fat suffices. It's a message, I believe. A calling for a significant act. As you are the only one I know who endures being called Fitz, I believe it's for you. As for what it means, how should I know? I'm a fool, not an interpreter of dreams. Good day.
Again he turned away from me. But this time, instead of continuing up the path, he stepped off it, into a clump of buckbrush. I hurried after him, but when I got to where he had left the path, he was gone. I stood still, peering into the open, sun-dappled woods, thinking I should see a bush still swaying from his passage, or catch a glimpse of his motley jacket. But there was no sign of him, and no sense at all to his silly message. I mulled over the strange encounter all the way back to Buckkeep, but in the end, I set it aside as a strange but random occurrence. Not that night, but the next. Chade called me. Burning with curiosity, I raced up the stairs, but when I reached the top, I halted, knowing that my questions would have to wait. For there sat Chade at the stone table, Slink perched atop his shoulders, and a new scroll half unwound on the table before him. A glass of wine waited one end, as his crooked finger travelled slowly down some sort of listing. I glanced at it as I passed. It was a list of villages and dates. Beneath each village name was a tally. So many warriors, so many merchants, so many sheep or casks of ale, or measures of grain, and so on. I sat down on the opposite side of the table and waited. I had learned not to interrupt Chade.
"My boy,"
he said softly, without looking up from the scroll.
"What would you do if some ruffian walked up behind you and rapped you on the head?"
"But only when your back was turned. How would you handle it?" I thought, briefly. "I'd turn my back and pretend to be looking at something else. Only I'd have a long, thick stick in my hands, so when he rapped me, I'd spin around and break his head."
Yes. Well, we tried that. But no matter how nonchalant we are, the Out-Islanders always seem to know when we are baiting them and never attack. Well, actually, we've managed to fool one or two of the ordinary raiders, but never the Red Ship raiders. And those are the ones we want to hurt.
Why?
Because they are the ones that are hurting us the worst. You see, boy, we are used to being raided. You could almost say that we've adapted to it. Plant an extra acre, weave another bolt of cloth, raise an extra steer. Our farmers and townsfolk always try to put a bit extra by, and when someone's barn gets burned, or a warehouse is torched in the confusion of a raid, everyone turns out to raise the beams again. But the Red Ship raiders aren't just stealing, and destroying in the process of stealing. they're destroying, and what they actually carry off with them seems almost incidental. Chade paused and stared at a wall as if seeing through it. It makes no sense. He continued bemusedly, more to himself than me, or at least no sense that I can unravel. It's like killing a cow that bears a good calf every year. Red Ship raiders torch the grain and hay still standing in the fields. They slaughter the stock they can't carry off. 3 weeks ago in Tornsby, they set fire to the mill and slashed open the sacks of grain and flour there. Where's the profit in that for them? Why do they risk their lives simply to destroy? They've made no effort to take and hold territory. They have no grievance against us that they've ever uttered. A thief you can guard against. But these are random killers and destroyers. Tornsby won't be rebuilt. The folk that survived have neither the will nor the resources. They've moved on. Some to family in other towns, others to be beggars in our cities. It's a pattern we're seeing too often. He sighed, and then shook his head to clear it. When he looked up, he focused on me totally. It was a knack Chade had. He could set aside a problem so completely you would swear he had forgotten it. Now he announced, as if it were his only care. You'll be accompanying Verity when he goes to reason with Lord Kelvar at Neatbay. So Burridge told me. But he wondered, and so do I. Why? Chade looked perplexed. Didn't you complain a few months ago that you had wearied of Buckkeep and wished to see more of the six duchies? Certainly. But I rather doubt that that is why Verity is taking me. Chade snorted. As if Verity paid any attention as to who makes up his retinue. He has no patience with the details, and hence none of chivalry's genius for handling people. Yet Verity is a good soldier, and in the long run perhaps that will be what we need. No, you are right. Verity has no inkling as to why you are going. Yet. Shrewd will tell him. You are trained as a spy. And that is all for now. He and I have consulted together upon this. Are you ready to begin repaying all he has done for you? Are you ready to begin your service for the family? He said it so calmly and looked at me so openly that it was almost easy to be calm as I asked, Will I have to kill someone? Perhaps. He shifted in his chair. You'll have to decide that. Deciding and then doing it. It's different from simply being told, That is the man, and it must be done. It's much harder. And I'm not all that sure you're ready. Would I ever be ready? I tried to smile and grinned like a muscle spasm. I tried to wipe it away and couldn't. A strange quiver passed through me. Probably not. Chade fell silent, and then decided that I had accepted the mission. You'll go as an attendant for an elderly noblewoman who is also going along to visit relatives at Neat Bay. It will not be too heavy a task for you. She is very elderly, and her health is not good. Lady Time travels in a closed litter. You will ride beside it, to see she is not jolted too much, to bring her water if she asks for it, and to see to any other such small requests. It doesn't sound too different from caring for Verity's wolfhound. Chade paused, then smiled. Excellent. That will fall to you as well. Become indispensable to everyone on this journey. Then you will have reasons to go everywhere and hear everything, and no one will question your presence. And my real task? To listen and learn. It seems to both Shrewd and me that these Red Ship raiders are too well acquainted with our strategies and strengths. Kelvar has recently begrudged the funds to staff the Watch Island Tower properly. Twice he has neglected it, and twice have the coast villages of Shoke's duchy paid for his negligence. Has he gone beyond negligence to treachery? Does Kelvar confer with the enemy to his profit? We want you to sniff about and see what you can discover. If all you find is innocence, or if you have but strong suspicions, bring news back to us. But if you discover treachery, and you are certain of it, then we cannot be rid of him too soon. And the means? I was not sure that was my voice. It was so casual, so contained. I have prepared a powder, tasteless in a dish, colorless in a wine. We trust to your ingenuity and discretion in applying it.
He lifted a cover from an earthenware dish on the table. Within it was a packet made of very fine paper, thinner and finer than anything Fedrin had ever shown me. Odd, how my first thought was how much my scribe master would love to work with paper like that. Within the packet was the finest of white powders. It clung to the paper and floated in the air. Chade shielded his mouth and nose with a cloth as he tapped a careful measure of it into a twist of oiled paper. He held it out to me, and I took death upon my open palm. And how does it work?
Not too quickly. He will not fall dead at the table, if that is what you are asking. But if he lingers over his cup, he will feel ill. Knowing Kelvar, I suspect he will take his bubbling stomach to bed, and never awaken in the morning.
I slipped it into my pocket. Does Verity know anything of this?
Chade considered. Verity is as good as his name. He could not sit at table with a man he was poisoning and conceal it. No, in this endeavor, stealth will serve us better than truth.
He looked me directly in the eyes.
You will work alone, with no counsel other than your own.
I see. I shifted on my tall wooden stool. Chade.
Yes?
Is this how it was for you? Your first time? He looked down at his hands, and for a moment he fingered the angry red scars that dotted the back of his left hand. The silence grew long, but I waited.
I was a year older than you are,
he said at last,
and it was simply the doing of it, not the deciding if it should be done. Is that enough for you?
I was suddenly embarrassed, without knowing why. I suppose, I mumbled.
Good. I know you meant no harm by it, boy, but men don't talk about times spent among the pillows with a lady, and assassins don't talk about our business.
Not even teacher to pupil? Chade looked away from me, to a dark corner of the ceiling.
No.
After a moment more, he added,
2 weeks from now, you'll perhaps understand why.
And that was all we ever said about it. By my count, I was 13 years old. 8. Lady Time. A history of the duchies is a study of their geography. The court scribe of King Shrewd, Juan Fedrin, was very fond of this saying. I cannot say I have ever found it wrong. Perhaps all histories are recounting of natural boundaries. The seas and ice that stood between us and the out-islanders made us separate peoples, and the rich grasslands and fertile meadows of the duchies created the riches that made us enemies. Perhaps that would be the first chapter of a history of the duchies. The Bear and the Vin rivers are what created the rich vineyards and orchards of Tilth, as surely as the Painted Edges mountains rising above Sand's Edge both sheltered and isolated the folk there and left them vulnerable to our organized armies. I jerked awake before the moon had surrendered her reign over the sky, amazed that I had slept at all. Burridge had supervised my travel preparations so thoroughly the night before that, had it been left to me, I would have departed a minute after I had swallowed my morning porridge. But such is not the way when a group of folk set out together to do anything. The sun was well over the horizon before we were all assembled and ready.
Royalty, Chade had warned me, never travels light. Verity goes on this journey with the weight of the king's sword behind him. All folk who see him pass know that without being told. The news must run ahead to Kelvar and to Shemshai. The Imperial Hand is about to reconcile their differences. They must both be left wishing they had never had any differences at all. That is the trick of good government, to make folk desire to live in such a way that there is no need for its intervention. So Verity travelled with a pomp that clearly irritated the soldier in him. His picked troop of men wore his colours as well as the Farseer buck badges, and rode ahead of the regular troops. To my young eyes, that was impressive enough. But to keep the impact from being too martial, Verity brought with him noble companions to provide conversation and diversion at the end of each day. Hawks and hounds with their handlers, musicians and bards, one puppeteer, those who fetched and carried for the lords and ladies, those who sought their garments and hair, and the cooking of favourite dishes, baggage beasts, all trailed behind the well-mounted nobles, and made the tail of our procession. My place was about midway in the procession. I sat a restive sooty beside an ornate litter borne between two sedate grey geldings. Hans, one of the brighter stable boys, had been assigned a pony and given charge of the horses bearing the litter. I would manage our baggage mule and see to the litter's occupant. This was the very elderly Lady Time, who I had never met before. When she at last appeared to mount her litter, she was so swathed in cloaks, veils, and scarves that I received only the impression that she was elderly in a gaunt rather than plump way, and that her perfume caused Sooty to sneeze. She settled herself in the litter amidst a nest of cushions, blankets, furs, and wraps, then immediately ordered that the curtains be drawn and fastened, despite the fineness of the morning. The two little maids who had attended her darted happily away, and I was left, her sole servant. My heart sank. I had expected at least one of them to travel within the litter with her. Who was going to see to her personal needs when her pavilion was set up? I had no notion as to waiting on a woman, let alone a very elderly one. I resolved to follow Burridge's advice for a young man dealing with elderly women. Be attentive and polite, cheerful and pleasant of mien. Old women were easily won over by a personable young man. Burridge said so. I approached the litter. "Lady Time, are you comfortable?" I inquired. A long interval passed with no response. Perhaps she was slightly deaf. "Are you comfortable?" I asked more loudly.
"Stop bothering me, young man,"
was the surprisingly vehement response.
"If I want you, I'll tell you."
"I beg pardon." I quickly apologized.
"Stop bothering me, I said,"
she rasped indignantly, and added in an undertone,
"Stupid churl."
At this, I had the sense to be quiet, though my dismay increased tenfold. So much for a merry and companionable ride. Eventually, I heard the horns cry out and saw Verity's pennant lifted far ahead of us. Dust drifting back told me that our foreguard had begun the journey. Long minutes passed before the horses in front of us moved. Hans started the litter horses, and I chirruped to Sooty. She stepped out eagerly, and the mule followed resignedly. I well recall that day. I remember the dust hanging thick in the air from all those who preceded us, and how Hans and I conversed in lowered voices. For the first time we laughed aloud, Lady Time scolded, "Stop that noise!" I also remember bright blue skies arching from hill to hill as we followed the gentle undulations of the coast road. There were breathtaking views of the sea from the hilltops, and flower-scented air thick and drowsy in the vales. There were also the shepherdesses, all in a row atop a stone wall to giggle and point and blush at us while we passed. Their fleecy charges dotted the hillside behind them,
and Hans and I exclaimed softly at the way they had bundled their bright skirts to one side and knotted them up, leaving their knees and legs bare to the sun and wind. Sooty was restive and bored with our slow pace, while poor Hans was constantly nudging his old pony in the ribs to make it keep up. We stopped twice during the day to allow riders to dismount and stretch, and to let the horses water. Lady Tyne did not emerge from her litter, but one time Tartley reminded me that I should have brought her water by now. I bit my tongue and fetched her a drink. It was as close as we came to conversation. We halted when the sun was still above the horizon. Hans and I erected Lady Tyne's small pavilion while she dined within her litter from a wicker basket of cold meat, cheese, and wine that she had thoughtfully provided for herself. Hans and I fared more poorly. On soldiers' rations of hard bread and harder cheese and dried meat, in the midst of the meal, Lady Tyne demanded that I escort her from the litter to her pavilion. She emerged, draped and veiled as if for a blizzard. Her finery was of varying colours and degrees of age, but all had been both expensive and well cut at one time. Now, as she leaned heavily on me and tottered along, I smelled a repulsive conglomeration of dust and mildew and perfume, with an underlying scent of urine. She tartly dismissed me at the door, and warned me that she had a knife and would use it if I attempted to enter and bother her in any way.
"And well do I know how to use it, young man!"
She threatened me. Our sleeping accommodations were also the same as the soldiers, the ground and our cloaks. But the night was fine, and we made a small fire. Hans teased and giggled about my supposed lust for Lady Tyne, and the knife that awaited me if I should attempt to satisfy it. That led to a wrestling match between us, until Lady Tyne shrilled threats at us for keeping her awake. Then we spoke softly as Hans told me that no one had envied my assignment to her, that anyone who had ever journeyed with her avoided her ever after. He warned me also that my worst task was yet to come, but adamantly refused, though his eyes brimmed with tears of laughter, to let me know what it was. I fell asleep easily, for boy-like, I had put my true mission out of my head until I should have to face it. I awoke at dawn to the twittering of birds and the overwhelming stench of a brimming chamber-pot outside Lady Tyne's pavilion. Though my stomach had been hardened by cleaning stables and kennels, it was all I could force myself to do to dump it and cleanse it before returning it to her. By then she was harping at me through the tent door that I had not yet brought her water, hot or cold, nor cooked her porridge, whose ingredients she had set out. Hans had disappeared to share the troop's fire and rations, leaving me to deal with my tyrant. By the time I had served her on a tray that she assured me was slovenly arranged, and cleaned the dishes and pot, and returned all to her, the rest of the procession was almost ready to leave. But she would not allow her pavilion to be struck until she was safely within her litter. We accomplished that packing in frantic haste, and I found myself finally on my horse without a crumb of breakfast inside me. I was ravenous after my morning's work. Hans regarded my glum face with some sympathy and motioned me to ride closer to him. He leaned over to speak with me. Everyone but us had heard of her before. This with a furtive nod toward Lady Tyne's litter. The stench she makes every morning is a legend. Whitelock says she used to go along on a lot of chivalry's trips. She has relatives all over the six duchies, and not much to do except go visit them. All the men in the troop say they learned a long time ago to stay out of her range, or she puts them to a bunch of useless errands. Oh, and Whitelock sent you this. He says not to expect to sit down and eat as long as you're tending to her, but he'll try to set aside a bit for you each morning. Hans passed me a wad of camp bread with three rashers of bacon greasily cold inside it. It tasted wonderful. I wolfed down the first few bites greedily.
"Chill!" shrilled Lady Tyne from inside her pavilion. "What are you doing up there? Discussing your betters, I've no doubt. Get back to your position!" How are you to see to my needs if you're gallivanting ahead like that?
I quickly reined Sooty in and dropped back to a position alongside the litter. I swallowed a great lump of bread and bacon and managed to ask, "Is there anything your ladyship requires?"
"Don't talk with your mouth full," she snapped, "and stop bothering me, stupid clod."
And so it went. The road followed the coastline, and at our leaden pace, it took us a full 5 days to reach Neat Bay. Other than two small villages, our scenery consisted of windswept cliffs, gulls, meadows, and occasional stands of twisted and stunted trees. Yet to me, it seemed full of beauties and wonders, for every bend in the road brought me to a place I had never seen before. As our journey wore on, Lady Time became more tyrannical. By the fourth day she had a constant stream of complaints, few of which I could do anything about. Her litter swayed too much. It was making her ill. The water I brought from a stream was too cold, and from my own water bags too warm. The men and horses ahead of us were raising too much dust. They were doing it on purpose, she was sure, and tell them to stop singing those rude songs. With her to deal with, I had no time to think about killing, or not killing, Lord Kelvar, even if I had wanted to. Early on the fifth day, we saw the rising smoke of Neat Bay. By noon, we could pick out the larger buildings and the Neat Bay watchtower on the cliffs above the town. Neat Bay was a much gentler piece of land than Buck Keep. Our road wound down through a wide valley. The blue waters of Neat Bay itself opened wide before us. The beaches were sandy, and their fishing fleet was all shallow draft vessels with flat bottoms, or spunky little dories that rode the waves like gulls. Neat Bay didn't have the deep anchorage that Buckkeep did, so it was not the shipping and trading port that we were. But all the same, it seemed to me it would have been a fine place to live. Kelvar sent an honor guard to meet us, so there was a delay as they exchanged formalities with Verity's troops.
"Like two dogs sniffing each other's bungholes," Hans observed sourly.
By standing in my stirrups, I was able to see far enough down the line to observe the official posturings, and grudgingly nodded my agreement. Eventually we got under way again, and were soon riding through the streets of Neat Bay town itself. Everyone else proceeded straight up to Kelvar's keep, but Hans and I were obliged to escort Lady Time's litter through several back streets to reach the particular inn that she insisted on using. From the look on the chambermaid's face, she had guessed it there before. Hans took the litter horses and litter to the stables, but I had to endure her leaning heavily on my arm as I escorted her to her chamber. I wondered what she had eaten that had been so foully spiced as to make her every breath a trial to me. She dismissed me at the door, warning myriad punishments if I didn't return promptly in 7 days. As I left, I felt sympathy for the chambermaid, for Lady Time's voice was lifted in a loud tirade about thieving maids she had encountered in the past, and exactly how she wanted the bed linens arranged on the bed. With a light heart, I mounted Sooty and called to Hans to make haste. We cantered through the streets of Neat Bay and managed to rejoin the tail of Verity's procession as they entered Kelvar's keep. Bay Guard was built on flat land that offered little natural defense, but was fortified by a series of walls and ditches that an enemy would have had to surmount before facing the stout stone walls of the keep. Hans told me that raiders had never gotten past the second ditch, and I believed him. Workmen were doing maintenance on the walls and ditches as we passed, but they halted and watched in wonder as the king-in-waiting came to Bay Guard. Once the keep gates closed behind us, there was another interminable welcoming ceremony. Men and horses and all, we were all kept standing in the midday sun while Kelvar and Baygard welcomed Verity. Horns sounded, and then the mutter of official voicings muted by shifting horses and men. But at last it was over. This was signaled by a sudden general movement of men and beasts as the formations ahead of us broke up. Men dismounted, and Kelvar's stable folk were suddenly among us, directing us where to water our mounts, where we might rest for the night, and most important to any soldier, where we might wash ourselves and eat. I fell in beside Hans as we led Sooty and his pony toward the stables. I heard my name called and turned to see Sig from Buck Keep, pointing me out to someone in Kelvar's colors.
"There he be. That's the Fitz. Oh, Fitz! Sitzwell here says you're summoned. Verity wants you in his chamber. Leon's sick. Hans, you take Sooty for the Fitz."
I could almost feel the food being snatched from my jaws. But I took a breath and presented a cheerful countenance to Sitzwell, as Burridge had counseled me. I doubt that doer man even noticed. To him I was just one more boy underfoot on a hectic day. He took me to Verity's chamber and left me, obviously relieved to return to his stables. I tapped softly, and Verity's man opened the door at once.
"Ah, thank Eden, it's you. Come in, then. For the beast won't eat, and Verity's sure it's serious. Hurry up, Fitz."
The man wore Verity's badge, but was no one I remembered having met. Sometimes it was disconcerting how many folk knew who I was, when I had no inkling who they were. In an adjoining chamber, Verity was splashing and instructing someone loudly about what garments he wished for the evening. But he was not my concern. Leon was. I quested toward him, but I had no qualms about it when Burridge wasn't about. Leon lifted his bony head and regarded me with martyred eyes. He was lying on Verity's sweaty shirt in a corner by a cold hearth. He was too hot. He was bored. And if we weren't going to hunt anything, he wanted to go home. I made a show of running my hands over him and lifting his lips to examine his gums and then pressing my hand down firmly on his belly. I finished all this by scratching behind his ears, and then told Verity's man, "There's nothing wrong with him. He just isn't hungry. Let's give him a bowl of cold water and wait. When he wants to eat, he'll let us know. And let's take away all this before it spoils in this heat and he eats it anyway and becomes really sick." I referred to a dish already overfilled with scraps of pastries from a tray that had been set for Verity. None of it was fit for the dog, but I was so hungry I wouldn't have minded dining off the scraps myself. In fact, my stomach growled at the sight of it. I wonder if I found the kitchens, if they would have a fresh beef bone for him. Something that's more toy than food is what he would welcome most now.
"Fit, is that you? In here, boy! What's troubling my Leon?"
"I'll fetch the bone," the man assured me, and I rose and stepped to the entry of the adjoining room.
Verity rose, dripping from his bath, and took the proffered towel from his serving man. He toweled his hair briskly, and then again demanded as he dried himself, "What's the matter with Leon?" That was Verity's way. Weeks had passed since we had last spoken, but he took no time for greetings. Chade said it was a lack in him, that he didn't make his men feel their importance to him. I think he believed that if anything significant had happened to me, someone would have told him. He had a bluff heartiness to him that I enjoyed, an attitude that things must be going well unless someone had told him otherwise.
"Not much is wrong with him, sir. He's a bit out of sorts from the heat and from travelling. A night's rest in a cool place will perk him up. But I'd not fill him full of pastry bits and suety things. Not in this hot weather."
"Well," Verity bent down to dry his legs. "Like as not, you're right, boy. Burridge says you've a way with the hounds, and I won't ignore what you say. It's just that he seems so moony, and usually he has a good appetite for anything, but especially for anything from my plate." He seemed abashed, as if caught cooing at an infant. I didn't know what to say.
"If that's all, sir, should I be returning to the stables?"
He glanced at me over his shoulder, puzzled. "Seems a bit of a waste of time to me. Hans will see to your mount, won't he? You need to bathe and dress if you're to be on time for dinner. Charon, have you water for him?"
The serving man straightened from arranging Verity's garments on the bed.
"Right away, sir, and I'll lay out his clothes as well."
In the space of the next hour, my place in the world seemed to shift topsy-turvy.
I had known this was coming. Both Burrich and Chade had tried to prepare me for it. But to suddenly go from an insignificant hanger-on at Buck Keep to part of Verity's formal entourage was a bit unnerving. Everyone else assumed I knew what was going on. Verity was dressed and out of the room before I was into the tub. Charim informed me that he had gone to confer with his captain of guards. I was grateful that Charim was such a gossip. He did not consider my rank so lofty as to forbear chatting and complaining in front of me.
"I'll make you up a pallet in here for the night. I doubt you'll be chill. Verity said he wanted you housed close by him, and not just to tend the hound. He has other chores for you as well."
Charim paused hopefully. I covered my silence by ducking my head into the lukewarm water and soaping the sweat and dust from my hair. I came up for air. He sighed.
"I'll lay out your clothes for you. Leave me those dirty ones. I'll wash them out for you."
It seemed very strange to have someone waiting on me while I washed, and stranger still to have someone supervise my dressing. Charim insisted on straightening the seams on my jerkin, and seeing the oversized sleeves on my new best shirt hung to their fullest and most annoying length. My hair had regrown long enough to have snarls in it, and these he tugged quickly and painfully out. To a boy accustomed to dressing himself, the primping and inspection seemed endless.
"Blood will tell,"
said an awed voice from the entry. I turned to find Verity beholding me, with a mixture of pain and amusement on his face.
"He's the image of chivalry at that age, is he not, my lord?"
Charim sounded immensely pleased with himself.
"He is."
Verity paused to clear his throat.
"No man can doubt who fathered you, Fitz."
"I wonder what my father was thinking when he told me to show you well. Shrewd he is called, and shrewd he is. I wonder what he expects to gain."
"Ah, well," he sighed. "This is his kind of kingship, and I leave it to him. Mine is simply to ask a foppish old man why he cannot keep his watchtowers properly manned. Come, boy, it's time we went down."
He turned and left without waiting for me. As I hastened after him, Charim caught at my arm.
"3 steps behind him and on his left, remember."
And that is where I fell in behind him. As he moved down the hallway, others of our entourage stepped out from their chambers and followed their prince. All were decked in their most elaborate finery to maximize this chance to be seen and envied outside of Buck Keep. The fullness of my sleeves was quite reasonable compared with what some were sporting. At least my shoes were not hung with tiny chiming bells or gently rattling amber beads. Verity paused at the top of the stairway, and a hush fell over the folk gathered below. I looked out over the faces turned up to their prince, and had time to read on them every emotion known to mankind. Some women simpered, while others appeared to sneer. Some young men struck poses that displayed their clothes, others dressed more simply, straightened as if to be on guard. I read envy and love, disdain, fear, and on a few faces, hatred. But Verity gave none of them more than a passing glance before he descended. The crowd parted before us to reveal Lord Kelvar himself, waiting to conduct us into the dining hall. Kelvar was not what I expected. Verity had called him foppish. But what I saw was a rapidly aging man, thin and harried, who wore his extravagant clothes as if they were armor against time. His graying hair was pulled back in a thin tail, as if he were still a man-at-arms, and he walked with that peculiar gait of the very good swordsman. I saw him as Chade had taught me to see folk, and thought I understood him well enough even before we were seated. But it was after we had taken our places at table, and mine, to my surprise, was not so far down from the high folk, that I got my deepest glance into the man's soul, and this not by any act of his, but in the bearing of his lady as she arrived to join us. I doubt if Kelvar's Lady Grace was much more than a hand of years older than I, and she was decked out like a magpie's nest, Never had I seen accoutrements before that spoke so garishly of expense and so little of taste. She took her seat in a flurry of flourishes and gestures that reminded me of a courting bird. Her scent rolled over me like a wave, and it, too, smelled of coin more than flowers. She had brought a little dog with her, a Feist that was all silky hair and big eyes. She cooed over him as she settled him on her lap, and the little beast cuddled against her and set his chin on the edge of the table. And all that time her eyes were on Prince Verity, trying to see if he marked her and was impressed. For my part, I watched Kelvar watch her perform her flirtations for the prince, and I thought to myself, there is more than half our problems with keeping the watchtowers manned. Dinner was a trial to me. I was ravenous, but manners forbade that I show it. I ate as I had been instructed, picking up my spoon when Verity did, and setting aside a course as soon as he showed disinterest in it. I longed for a good platter of hot meat with bread to sop up the juices, but what we were offered were tidbits of meat oddly spiced, exotic fruit compotes, pale breads, and vegetables cooked to pallor and then seasoned. It was an impressive display of good food abused in the name of fashionable cooking. I could see that Verity's appetite was as slack as mine, and wondered if all could see that the prince was not impressed. Chade had taught me better than I had known. I was able to nod politely to my dinner companion, a freckled young woman, and follow her conversation about the difficulty of getting good linen fabric in Ripon these days, while letting my ears stray enough to pick up key bits of talk about the table. None of it was about the business that had brought us here. Verity and Lord Kelvar would closet themselves tomorrow for the discussion of that. But much of what I overheard touched on the manning of Watch Island's tower and cast odd lights on it. I overheard grumblings that the roads were not as well maintained as previously. Someone commented that she was glad to see that repair on Baygard's fortifications had been resumed. Another man complained that inland robbers were so common he could scarcely count on 2/3 of his merchandise coming through from Faro. This, too, seemed to be the basis of my dining companion's complaint about the lack of good fabric. I looked at Lord Kelvar, and how he doted upon his young wife's every gesture. As if Chade were whispering in my ear, I heard his judgment. There is a duke whose mind is not upon the governing of his duchy. I suspected Lady Grace was wearing the required road repairs and the wages of those soldiers who would have kept his trade routes policed against brigands. Perhaps the jewels that dangled from her ears should have gone to pay to man Watch Island's towers. Dinner finally ended. My stomach was full, but my hunger unabated. There had been so little substance to the meal. Afterward, two minstrels and a poet entertained us, but I turned my ears to the casual talk of folk rather than to the fine phrasings of the poet or the ballads of the minstrels. Kelvar sat to the prince's right, while his lady sat to the left, her lapdog sharing the chair. Grace sat, basking in the prince's presence. Her hands often strayed to touch first an earring, then a bracelet. She was not accustomed to wearing so much jewelry. My suspicion was that she had come of simple stock and was awed by her own position. One minstrel sang, "Fair rose amidst the clover," his eyes on her face, and was rewarded with her flushed cheeks. But as the evening wore on and I grew weary, I could tell that Lady Grace was fading. She yawned once, lifting a hand too late to cover it. Her little dog had gone to sleep in her lap and twitched and yipped occasionally in his small-brained dreams. As she grew sleepier, she reminded me of a child. She cuddled her dog as if it were a doll, and leaned her head back into the corner of her chair. Twice she started to nod off. I saw her surreptitiously pinching the skin on her wrists in an effort to wake herself up. She was visibly relieved when Kelvar summoned the minstrels and poet forward to reward them for their evening. She took her lord's arm to follow him off to their bedchamber,
while never relinquishing the dog she snugged in her arm. I was relieved to make my way up to Verity's antechamber. Charum had found me a feather bed and some blankets. My pallet was fully as comfortable as my own bed. I longed to sleep. But Charum gestured me into Verity's bedchamber. Verity, ever the soldier, had no use for lackeys to stand about and tug his boots off for him. Charum and I alone attended him. Charum clucked and muttered as he followed Verity about, picking up and smoothing the garments the prince so casually shed. Verity's boots he immediately took off into a corner and began working more wax into the leather. Verity dragged a nightshirt on over his head, and then turned to me. "Well, what have you to tell me?" And so I reported to him as I did to Chade, recounting all I had overheard in as close to the words as I could manage, and noting who had spoken and to whom. At the last, I added my own suppositions about the significance of it all. Kelvar is a man who has taken a young wife, one who is easily impressed with wealth and gifts. I summarized. She has no idea of the responsibilities of her own position, let alone his. Kelvar diverts money, time, and thoughts from his duties to enthralling her. Were it not disrespectful to say so, I would imagine that his manhood is failing him, and he seeks to satisfy his young bride with gifts as a substitute. Verity sighed heavily. He had flung himself onto the bed during the latter half of my recitation. Now he prodded at a too-soft pillow, folding it to give more support to his head. "Damn chivalry," he said absently. "This is his kind of knot, not mine. Fitz, you sound like your father, and were he here, he'd find some subtle way to handle this whole situation. Shiv would have had it solved by now, with one of his smiles and a kiss on someone's hand. But that's not my way, and I won't pretend to it." He shifted about in his bed uncomfortably, as if he expected me to raise some argument to him about his duty. Kelvar's a man and a duke, and he has a duty. He's to man that tower properly. It's simple enough, and I intend to tell him that bluntly. Put decent soldiers in that tower and keep them there, and keep them happy enough to do a job. It seems simple to me, and I'm not going to make it into a diplomatic dance. He shifted heavily in the bed, then abruptly turned his back to me. "Put out the light, Charum." And Charum did, so promptly that I was left standing in the dark and had to blunder my way out of the chamber and back to my own pallet. As I lay down, I pondered that Verity saw so little of the whole. He could force Kelvar to man the tower, yes, but he couldn't force him to man it well, or take pride in it. That was a matter for diplomacy. And had he no heed for the roadwork and maintenance on the fortifications and the highwaymen problem? All that needed to be remedied now, and in such a way that Kelvar's pride was kept intact, and that his position with Lord Shemshai was both corrected and affirmed. And someone had to undertake to teach Lady Grace her responsibilities. So many problems. But as soon as my head touched the pillow, I slept. 9. Fat suffices. The fool came to Buckkeep in the 17th year of King Shrewd's reign. This is one of the few facts that are known about the fool. Said to be a gift from the Bingtown traders, the origin of the fool can only be surmised. Various stories have arisen. One is that the fool was a captive of the Red Ship raiders, and that the Bingtown traders seized the fool from them. Another is that the fool was found as a babe, adrift in a small boat, shielded from the sun by a parasol of shark skin and cushioned from the thwarts by a bed of heather and lavender. This can be dismissed as a creation.